Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today we have a number of bills for public hearing, possible work sessions, as well as some work sessions scheduled and a public hearing on its own. I'm going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 839. We do have a representative here, so I want to go ahead and get that one open. And Eric, why don't you give us an overview?
Sure. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 839 comes to this committee from Senator Bates, Cruz, Steiner, Hayward, Representative Williamson, Shemaya Fagan, Peluso, Taylor, and Wilson. The bill provides immunities for certain offenses when evidence is obtained in response to a request for medical assistance for drug overdoses. There is one amendment, the -1 amendment, which limits those immunities to and eliminates the immunities for out-of-state warrants and federal warrants. There is no fiscals back of the -1 amendment.
Okay. So I have a panel, I guess, that's going to start off on the hearing with Representative Fagan, Paul Lewis, and Rob Bovet. If you all three would be so kind to come forward. Good morning. And Rob, I understand you may be teeing off.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovett, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I've been asked to just briefly explain what Senate Bill 839 does, since I was the primary scrivener of the bill, to kind of cue it up for everybody. So what the basic contents of the bill are that it provides for immunity from arrest and prosecution for those that call in an overdose, whether the person calling in is the person undergoing the overdose or someone who is observing someone else undergo the overdose. So the basic structure is under and that's what subsection 1 does. Subsection 2 identifies the laundry list of crimes that people are granted immunity from under that scenario. Subsection 3 does that. Subsection 4 basically says that people shall not be arrested for violating their pretrial release and other such things as a result of that type of behavior. And then subsection 5 really goes further than many of the other states have gone with these Good Samaritan bills, and I think appropriately so, by extending that immunity to being arrested for certain outstanding warrants, namely probation violations in certain circumstances, violation of post-prison supervision in certain circumstances. I should have said at the beginning, there are about 20 states with these Good Samaritan laws. Claudia Black and I from Multnomah County examined all of those before we crafted this bill and tried to craft something that made sense within the context of Oregon law. The -1 amendments, because our initial draft was not perfect, of course, the -1 amendments clean up subsection 5 and make the language flow back to the subsection 3 enumerated statutes with all three categories of PVs, post-prison supervision violations, et cetera, to make it all flow correctly. So that's got a technical correction in it, as well as something we forgot to exclude, which is making it clear that this can't and really shouldn't grant immunity from arrest for federal warrants or out-of-state warrants. And that's what the -1s do. So that's the structure of the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions about it if you have any technical questions, and I'll turn it over to those who want to testify about the substance.
All right, thank you. Who is going to walk us through the next part? Representative for
great.
Mr. Lewis?
Thanks. My name's Paul Lewis, so Chair Brzezinski and other members of the committee. Thank you for putting this on the agenda. Rob just explained what the Good Samaritan bill does. Bible scholars will remember the parable of the Good Samaritan is when a person was robbed and injured along a road, and a number of people passed by and specifically avoided them, and then a Samaritan stopped and not only cared for the person, but also took them to an inn and then paid the innkeeper for any future expenses. So the idea was that it was the love your neighbor commandment. We want people to be able to help others in need without fearing that something would happen to them. As you're aware from many other things that have been brought before you in the last decade, both the U.S. and especially Oregon have really suffered from a huge increase in overdose deaths of all kinds, particularly related to opiates. Since 2006, at least a person a day has died in Oregon from a drug overdose for seven continuous years. Fortunately, prompt medical attention can help.
Paul, could you give us that stat again?
Yeah, so since, make sure I get my number right, from 06 to 12, the minimum number of deaths per year was 346. The maximum was 425.
Okay.
So I said one a day.
Pretty darn close. caught my attention.
You know, prompt medical attention can help in many cases in resuscitating people. And as you've heard before, with certain drugs, these overdoses can actually be reversed. So you would think that if someone was around, they'd call 911, et cetera. But people at scenes are concerned, and they're concerned because in the majority of cases, law enforcement responds along with medical. Law enforcement isn't there to arrest people. They're there to help save lives as well. But unfortunately, the perception in the community is that people may be arrested. A number of surveys have been done among intravenous drug users in Seattle and Portland, and about a third of them say that they didn't call 911 because they were concerned about arrests. And in follow-up questions, the majority, nearly 90%, said if there were a Good Samaritan law, they would call 911. So again, we think it's more a perception issue. We don't think that the police are there to arrest people at the scenes of overdose, but that perception is out there. And we feel that the Good Samaritan law would help us alter that. Rob mentioned there's 24 states with Good Samaritan laws plus D.C., and I also want to point out, we don't think that Good Samaritan law by itself will solve all our problems with overdoses. And I want you to know that those of us in public health and throughout social justice and health communities are working at many levels to try to decrease overdose deaths, not only things like the Good Samaritan law, giving the antidote, naloxone, getting people into treatment, providing access to effective medical treatment, trying to decrease the number of pills in circulation, and trying to change perceptions on what is the best way to treat pain. So anyway, thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. Thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill today. I'm going to share a personal story. In January of 2009, I was enjoying the last few days of my Christmas break before my third semester or my final semester of my final year of law school began. And I received a call one morning from my mom's boss that my mom had just been transported to the hospital, Portland Adventist, by ambulance, and that she was currently in the ICU. So I rushed to the hospital to find that she was in a coma in the ICU, and she had overdosed on opiates. My mom has a long history of drug addiction throughout my whole life, and at least at the time they were very uncertain whether she would wake up, and if she did, whether she would have suffered severe brain damage, because she went for almost 12 hours that she was overdosed before she was actually transported. And the reason is because her spouse at the time was also high, and once he realized that she wasn't responsive, that she was overdosed, he was afraid to call the police because he was afraid that he was going to get in trouble. And it wasn't until they at the time were living with his parents, and at the time one of his brothers came over, saw my mom, and said, "Oh my!" And that's the only reason that she ended up actually getting to the hospital, was because her brother-in-law called. And then even when we were at the hospital, by the time I got there, the doctors approached me and they were very confused, because her spouse was saying that, at most there was maybe marijuana in her system, because he was even afraid to tell the doctors the extent of the drugs that might be in her system, because he was afraid of getting in trouble. So this is something that obviously is very near and dear to my heart, that we need to make sure that there is this immunity, so that someone in my former stepdad's position can feel confident to report a medical emergency. Now, though not germane to the bill, the good news is that was her rock bottom. She ended up leaving her spouse, moving to Eastern Oregon, and being clean and sober for the next 5.5 years. We lost her unexpectedly in October to complications from a routine surgery. But we would not have had those 5.5 years of her being clean and sober, becoming a, you know, integral part of her grandkids' lives, had it not been for her getting to the hospital. And so we almost lost her, thanks to just the brother-in-law happening to stop by that morning. And my stepfather would definitely not have called the police at any point, because he was afraid of the police. So that's my support for this bill, and I certainly urge you to support it. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to be Senator Bates, Rod Underhill, and Paul Stiegler, I believe? Seidler.
Good morning. Actually, I'll start this off. Is that okay?
Yes, please.
We haven't planned anything together here. For the record, Senator Alan Bates, Senate District 3. I'm also a family physician. I'm going to speak in support of this bill from two different areas. I'm going to tell you anything you haven't heard already, but I'll try to reinforce some information you may already have. Number one, I've used this drug many, many times in my practice, especially in my training, and when I used to be chief of medicine at two hospitals where I would often work as a backup in the emergency room. Narcan, as we used to call it, is an extremely safe drug and rather miraculous when given. We would usually give it IV, which is not the way it's given in the street. It's given IM, that's intramuscularly, or by spray. Still very effective, saves lives, saves brains. When we do it in the hospital setting, we give it IVs, people immediately sit up and ask where they're at and what's going on and what happened. It completely reverses the narcotic effect. We also use it as a test drug. We have people come in who are comatose. We check their blood sugar, and commonly we'll give them a shot of Narcan if we think that's what's going on. And we don't wait for toxicology screens or the rest of it. We're trying to save a life and save a brain before more damage is done. And we often give it repetitively. It's a short-acting drug. And we often have to give it every 15, 20 minutes till we can get them on a vent and get them straightened out and save their brain. So it's a great drug to use. The real issue before you, obviously, is should we allow more people in the public to use this drug? And I think we absolutely should. I see no downside to it. It's not a dangerous drug. The biggest problem, of course, is people who are overdosed are usually in a situation where those around them are also using drugs and obviously don't want to call the police in or call EMTs and get people in trouble. So the way it's written, from my understanding of it, and legally I'm not an attorney, and people have to make their own decisions about that, but the way I read this bill, it's done extremely well. It's a bill that we should have, and I think it'll do a great job in saving lives and what we call medicine saving brains. The other piece of this I want to talk to you about is we just got statistics out yesterday from Public Health and the other committee I chair. We're looking at the Public Health Department's budget and all information, things they do. They now are tracking deaths from overdoses. And there's been a sudden and precipitous drop in the number of people, especially males, dying from drug overdoses that started about 3 years ago. The drop is almost at a 45-degree angle. We were wondering why that was happening. They don't know why for sure, but I have a hunch I know where that is happening at. I think it's the use of Narcan in the drug community saving lives. This should accelerate that. I'm very happy to see those numbers coming in, and I'm sorry I didn't bring them to you today. I didn't have a chance to, been kind of busy. But I'll give that to the committee at a later time. You will be impressed by what's been happening in the last 2 or 3 years since the beginning of this program, and expanding, I believe, will only make it more effective. So I'll stop there, and I'll offer a testimony from other people here. I don't want to take up a lot of time, but things you've already heard about.
Thank you. Senator Bates, do you have time to stay with us, or should we see if there's any questions for you? I'm not sure if you need
I've got about another 5 minutes before I have to go back to my other committee, which I'm chairing this morning.
Let me just see. Are there any questions for Senator Bates? Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, not a question, just a comment. I think we expected this drop because of legislation that we have already passed in this legislative assembly, and in my mind, this is the next step in that process. I think this is total common sense. This isn't soft on crime, this is saving lives. And Dr. Bates and I have been involved in this for a while now, and this is, I appreciate the work we've done on this, so.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. I couldn't agree more. This is really the right thing to be doing.
Thank you. Senator, if you need to take off or when you need to take off, feel free to do so. Who'd like to go next?
Senator Brzezinski, I'll go ahead and go next. Welcome. My name is Paul Steiglitter, and for the members of the chair, I am a retired law enforcement officer from Clackamas County, did 28 and a half years there and a couple of years up in Sitka, Alaska. I'm here today not only on behalf of myself, but of the organization Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. LEAP is a worldwide organization that's looking to reduce deaths due to overdose and other types of drug-related injuries. We want to switch the situation from end users being criminalized and keep them in the public health realm. This is a social issue that we need to work on changing. So in the public interest, we continually need to move our police from a negative perspective into a positive perspective. When people pick up the phone and dial 911, they want a police officer to show up and medical personnel to show up, and they want us to treat that situation with respect and dignity, provide medical attention to the people that need it, but then don't turn the police officers into bad guys by having to go ahead and criminalize that person's choice or that person's behavior. So LEAP envisions a situation and a society where we're working to make logical changes in our efforts to combat drug use in our communities. This bill, 839, is a step in that right direction. If we can eliminate the fear of arrest, more people are going to call 911 for help when they're in these emergent situations. The numbers of decline in the amount of drug overdose deaths is happening. The alarming thing, though, is our veterans. Our veterans are dying at a more advanced rate than we would. It's alarming how many veterans are dying of drug-related overdoses. I'm not saying that this is going to be the be all to end all, but 839 is the next logical step in changing our society's perception of drug users, and it can save lives. So I urge you to support 839, and I'll turn that over to Rod Underhill then.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Rod Underhill. I'm the district attorney in Multnomah County. I come here today in full support of Senate Bill 839-1. I want to call out Senator Cruz for, number one, being bold and brave and being a sponsor of this bill, and an opportunity to also have an ear for the Dash One amendments that we thought were appropriate and helpful. The last time I was before this group, I had the opportunity to speak about saving lives in the area of gun dispossession as it relates to domestic violence. I am very pleased to be able to talk about that very same concept here. Senator Cruz, you hit the nail on the head. This is not soft on crime. This is finding an appropriate, fair balance to recognizing that members in our community, good people, our friends, our family, our neighbors, and strangers struggle daily with addiction. And this is a bill that tells them their lives still matter. Their lives still matter to government. Their lives still matter to members of the public safety. This is a bill that is going to allow us to both symbolically and realistically have an impact on just that statement. It is a noble statement, it is an appropriate statement. This bill creates that opportunity for those members to have an opportunity for success, because drug addiction is a life struggle, but we have countless, countless stories of success on the other side of drug addiction. But those success stories do not occur when we have a death-involved situation. But this will allow us to have more success stories and benefit all of us. So well done. I bring with you not just my support, but the Oregon District Attorneys Association's full support, and I've been authorized to announce that the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association is supportive of the 839-1 as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Cruz?
Maybe just one more comment, and I appreciate this. I think what we will discover, because as I understand it, when we administer this drug, it's not really a pleasant experience. And, you know, kind of ruins the buzz in more ways than one. I think what we will also discover anecdotally is that it's going to bring some people closer to the reality they need to face to actually begin to want to do something about their addiction. So, and as a recovering addict myself, just celebrated my 30th year anniversary, this is important. And what I do know is that addicts, you don't know what is going to trigger their understanding of what their problem is and their ability to seek help. And, you know, so this is not only going to save lives, but I think the use of this drug is going to also change some lives as well.
Well, thank you very much for sharing. Is there any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our next panel includes Haven Heaven Willock, I guess, and Michelle Chrisholm. I apologize.
Chairman, Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Haven Wheelock, and I am the program coordinator for the Syringe Exchange at Outside In. I'm here today to support this bill and to share what I'm hearing from the people I work with, as well as some of my personal experience with the fear people face when they're trying to access help for someone who is overdosing. In 2013, the legislature passed the Naloxone Access Bill. This bill allowed trained lay responders to administer the medication to reverse an overdose when someone was in trouble. Our organization, Outside In, began training our clients that same day that the law was actually enacted, and as of now, we've trained 1,100 drug users in the Portland metro area to use this drug. When we train the people, we ask people to report overdoses back to us if they actually are called to use this drug, and we have them come back to us. And as of yesterday, we've had 630 people tell us that they've used their naloxone in an overdose event. In these events, we try and gather some information from them because we want to kind of understand what is happening and what's going on and whether or not. So we do ask everyone to call 911, and we train people to call 911 because medical attention beyond a lay response is really important. What we're seeing is only about a third of people are making those phone calls. And the number one reason that they tell us that they're not calling is because they are afraid of law enforcement, and they don't want to interact with law enforcement. This is despite the fact that only four people have told me that anyone was arrested at the scene of the overdose. So they're not actually, the fear is there, but there's not a lot of arrests that are happening. It's also not uncommon for people to tell us that they would rather wait and see if the naloxone works before calling for help because they're afraid of police, or that they'll call 911 and then leave as soon as they hear sirens and just run and leave people. All of those things can delay the care that someone gets and delay the time that the person before either naloxone is given or follow-up care is for someone that may need it. I personally have been at the scene of 10 overdoses. And the reason they're bringing me in these situations is because they're scared. I've had two people drop overdosing unconscious people on the floor of my exchange and then leave saying that they can't call. They know I'll call 911, but they're scared to call. I've had people come and get me to respond to overdoses where we run several blocks away from my office and then have them be like, I can't stay because I'm scared of getting arrested. I've had people beg me not to make the 911 call in order to avoid having law enforcement there, and then once again leave as soon as I insist that I am not just going to naloxone someone and not follow up with that care. I'm grateful that none of these cases have resulted in lost lives, and that time delay between someone choosing to call me, a lay responder, into the situation as opposed to calling 911 directly hasn't resulted in lives lost. But I can't help but wonder what would have happened if I wouldn't have been there, if our office was not open. I'm proud of the success that we're having in Portland around naloxone, because we are having some success in lowering death. But I also want to say naloxone access across the state is still limited. Not a lot of places have programs for drug users. It's expanding slowly, but we're not there yet. So this law will provide a tool to people in more rural communities where they are less likely to have naloxone on hand, because really, in most of the state right now, the only way to get naloxone is to call 911. We're fortunate where I am. It's not likely to change, this law is not likely to change how law enforcement is behaving, because law enforcement aren't there to arrest people typically. However, this law will provide some peace of mind to some scared folks who are sitting there weighing the option of what's worse, getting arrested or how much they need an ambulance. So I encourage you to support this life-saving bill, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Chisholm, and I'm here as a grieving mother to share my personal experience in and asking for your support for this bill. In May of 2011, my son witnessed an overdose, a heroin overdose. He and his friends did everything to try to help their friend, everything except to call 911 because they were afraid. Thank you. This young woman died, and I remember just seeing his remorse, his grief, his sadness and anger, and beating himself up for not doing the right thing. A month later, my son died of a heroin overdose. He was with a friend using drugs in a hotel room, and in a panic, his friend also left and called 911 after he had left the scene. Till this day, I don't know if he would have been saved if 911 was called immediately, but I know that time matters. So I'm asking for your support in passing this bill to toss out the fear that anybody might have in calling for help immediately. I know this won't bring back Travis's friend. I know it won't bring back my son. But just knowing that it might save another life, it will bring happiness, and I know that my son will be proud of everyone's efforts in getting this bill passed. Thank you for your support.
Bill, thank you very much for coming forward and sharing your personal story. And let me ask if there's any questions.
Thank you.
Ladies, thank you very much. Claudia, I know that you're helping with this bill. I would like for you to please come up. I had a couple of questions, just wanted to follow up, and I think you might be in a better position to answer those. If you could just go ahead and put your name on the record.
Claudia Black, Government Relations Director for Multnomah County.
Yeah, Claudia, thank you very much for spearheading the bill. I'm wondering about PSAs. What are we going to do to try to get word out to the general public to alert them that they know that this is something that they, one, should be doing, and two, with the passage of the law, that it, that the say the perception or a concern of being somehow caught up in the legal system is not going to be warranted anymore.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we will work very closely with the state public health system in getting the word out, and with the local and statewide media. I think that this is a very big issue, as you pointed out. It's It's more of a perception than anything else, and we want to get the word out. We'll work with recovery centers and needle exchanges, and I think we have a pretty good network of getting the word out, so we're looking forward to getting people informed.
Right. Okay. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 839? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 839. And did you say this was ready, or is it, we'll hold on?
We don't have the fiscals yet. Okay. I was told if we rolled it over to Monday, we would have it by then.
All right. Well, we're going to just hold on to it for right now because we got some other stuff for fiscal, too. All right. So that we close the public hearing there. We're going to open up our next public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 694. Eric?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 694 comes to this committee from Senator Cruz, Hansel, Thompson, and Representatives Huffman, Lively, Widener, and Wilson. The bill would permit motorcycles or mopeds to move between lanes of traffic if traffic has slowed to 10 miles per hour or less. The Dash 1 amendment prohibits motorcycles or mopeds from splitting lanes when the lanes are traveling in the opposite direction. It also limits the lane splitting to public highways that have a speed of 50 miles per hour or more.
All right. So I have a panel that's going to come up first. It's Paula Leslie and I'm going to say Slater. I cannot read the first name. It looks like it's Christopher. Maybe it's Christopher. And then J.M. Broglio. Hopefully I didn't butcher that too much.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Thank you so much for allowing us to bring this bill forward. We've been waiting a long time for this. For the record, my name is Paula Leslie, Director of Bike Pack of Oregon. Bike Pack of Oregon represents a bait of Oregon and all of Oregon's motorcycle riders. We regularly participate in meetings and show up and try to be a part of our Oregon safety plan here as we move our mission statement forward. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous today.
Take your time.
Our mission statement is to promote motorcycle safety, awareness, education, and liberty. BikePak is here in support of Senate Bill 694, which allows motorcycle riders to ride between lanes of traffic during traffic jams and slowdowns. Historically, BikePak has attempted to bring this lane sharing bill forward, but the education of this bill and the concepts and concerns of our traffic safety advisors needed careful consideration before we could do that. I'm not only here as director of Bike Pack of Oregon, but I'm also here as an educator. I have a master's degree in health education, human performance, and sports psychology. I worked at Oregon State University for 10 years and currently work as a personal trainer. Some of the concerns that were brought up with our safety advisors were things like motorists being afraid that a motorcycle rider was going to come zipping up out of their blind spot and scare them to death. Other concerns were, as someone mentioned, the opposite movement of traffic in the lanes, issues with the highways going through tunnels, and there were a lot of issues. One of them also was the size of some of the new motorcycles, which are three-wheelers and are too big to fit between some of those lanes. As an educator with health and human performance, I can tell you that mental and physical fatigue is a huge issue in the safety of a motorcycle rider and could eventually lead to a medical emergency. Motorcycle riders are exposed to the elements, leaving them vulnerable to cold, heat, dehydration, vibration, wind, constant use of their SIPTI skills, which our Team Oregon instructor will go into detail on, which includes their situational awareness and their constant scanning of traffic and watching their mirrors. Other things include poor weather conditions, poor road conditions, heavy highway traffic, frequent and constant gear changes, and the physical fatigue of operating a motorcycle for long amounts of time without sufficient brakes. The impact of physical fatigue on the rider includes things like tiredness or cramping in their arms, hands, neck, back, feet, legs, their eyes, or their whole body. Now, when you're on a motorcycle, you have to keep your clutch closed when you're slowing down and you're stopped. So you've got the tightness in this arm right here, and then you've got your brake over here, and you've got your feet working to brake down below. Depending on what kind of motorcycle you ride, it's on one side or the other. If you have two different kinds of motorcycles, then it could be on the right one day, on the left the other day, just depending on what you are riding. I would like to also stress that the impact of fatigue on riding include things like slower reaction time, difficulty maintaining speed, difficulty braking and shifting, losing control of the bike and running off the road. So mental fatigue and physical fatigue are huge when it comes to high traffic jam situations where the rider is slowing down and speeding up and continually watching. Motorcycle riders are typically the most aware riders on the road because we're not changing our radios and eating our lunch and putting on our makeup and talking to the kids in the back seat. So we're really aware. Oh, one of the other issues that somebody had was coming out of your blind spot. And when the motorcycle rider is between the lines, that puts the motorcycle rider in your side mirror. They're no longer in the blind spot. The blind spot is actually in the lane next to you. This bill puts riders in charge of their own safety and removes them from a possible emergency situation, as well as many other benefits our witnesses here will explain with their testimony. Thank you again for allowing us to bring this bill forward, and we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I'll go next. Good morning, Senator Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Christopher Slater. I'm a motorcyclist and an attorney. I've been riding motorcycles since 1985. I received my first motorcycle endorsement in the state of California, where I rode there for a number of years and safely and legally split lanes as a motorcyclist. I've been an attorney in the state of Oregon since 1997, and in my current practice, I represent injured motorcyclists in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. The current transportation system that we have here in the state of Oregon, I think we all recognize, is coming under increasing strain. We know about the Columbia River crossing. We know about efforts to reduce congestion. We know about the new advisory speed warnings that have been installed on 217 and the interchange around the Portland metro area. So one of the things that I think is important is trying to incentivize alternate forms of transportation. And I'll use bicycles as an analogy when appropriate, because I think that's something we can look to when we look back 20 years where bicycles were, where they are today. I think there's a good analogy there for motorcycles. So currently, under Oregon law, motorcycles are treated identically as automobiles. The problem with that is motorcycles lack the safety features that automobiles have. Automobiles have now, we have crumple zones, we have supplemental restraint systems, obviously we have seat belts. We have evolving technology that improves the safety of the occupants of the automobile when there's an accident. Motorcycles lack all of those safety features. What the primary safety feature of a motorcycle is, its smaller size, better maneuverability, increased agility, better acceleration, better braking ability. So the actual key issue for motorcycles in terms of safety is collision avoidance, because the rider is exposed and there are no safety features on a motorcycle that are going to diminish the injuries a motorcyclist suffers if there's an impact with another vehicle. Currently, so using the bicycle analogy, 20 years ago when I first moved to Portland, we had some bike lanes, but little else. And bicycles were basically treated as automobiles or pedestrians by most municipalities, and you had bicycles riding in the street and on the sidewalks. Okay, but if you go into downtown Portland today, not only will you see bike lanes, you will see bike boxes at intersections. You have, on certain streets, you have actual bike signals now. And what has happened as a result? The safety of bicycling has improved. It's been incentivized. We have increased bicycles on the roadways around Portland and other metro areas in the state of Oregon. We have less cars on the road as a result. So with motorcycles, I think if we address the safety issues and incentivize their use, it's part of the puzzle of helping diminish the strain on Oregon's infrastructure, and reducing the number of cars that are on the road. So the United States is actually one of the only developed countries in the world that does not have lane splitting. Almost every country in Europe and developed countries in Asia, Australia, and other developed countries have lane splitting, and these are countries that tend to have more urban congestion. And so what that does in those cities is it incentivizes the use of smaller, more efficient vehicles, reduces traffic congestion, and lane splitting has been safely practiced in other countries for years. The state of California is the only state where it is practiced currently. Technically, it is not a permissive statute that allows lane splitting in the state of California. There is no statute that prohibits it. However, with the increasing popularity of motorcycling, and statistics will show that motorcycle use is on the rise in this country, more and more states are looking at lane splitting as a safety option and incentive for motorcyclists in their states. And we have a bill that just came out of the Washington Senate. California is currently looking at a bill that would put guidelines on lane splitting. So this is an emerging trend that's happening, and I hope that Oregon can be a leader in that trend with 694. So the key, and I brought a handout, a fact sheet, which I tried to summarize the most important aspects of the safety benefits of lane splitting. You'll hear the terms lane splitting, lane sharing, lane filtering. I've heard the term whitelining. These are generally interchangeable terms, but in my mind, I have a distinction between lane splitting and lane filtering. Lane splitting, generally speaking, and as it's practiced currently in California, is when traffic slows to a speed of 30 miles per hour or less, and the motorcycle travels between lanes at a speed differential of 10 miles per hour or less. Now, there is no law in the state of California that requires that that's how lane splitting practice is done. However, a UC Berkeley study that was done in 2013 showed that, in fact, in the majority of situations, motorcyclists in California were already practicing one or both of those features because lane splitting, frankly, isn't needed when speeds are traveling at freeway speeds of 55 miles per hour or greater. So in 1981, there was the Hurt Report. This is still one of the most comprehensive reports on motorcycle safety that showed the benefits of lane splitting to avoid rear-end collisions. Unfortunately, that report was the only report in the state in the United States for more than two decades. In 2000, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration commissioned to try and have a study done. Unfortunately, they didn't get the funding. You may be aware, in 2010, the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety proposed a similar study be done here in the state of Oregon. It was not funded, so it was not done. However, in 2013, the University of California at Berkeley did a study on lane splitting, and they compared accidents involving motorcycles with accidents involving motorcycles that involve lane splitting. And the data was very clear on the safety benefits of lane splitting. First of all, there were 42% fewer rear-end collisions in accidents involving lane splitting. There were 55% fewer fatalities, 45% fewer head injuries, 21% fewer neck injuries, 32% fewer torso injuries, and 12% fewer arm and leg injuries. And the reason for this is motorcycles are currently required to, in all other states, to occupy a lane like an automobile. And they're often forced to ride in the driver's blind spot. The blind spot is going to be in the lane. Next time you get in your car and drive, if you look in either side mirror, you're going to see a dotted line going all the way back. There is no blind spot in between the lanes. So by allowing motorcycles to split lanes when it's prudent and safe to do so, it's taking the motorcycle out of the blind spot and putting them in the clear side view mirror of the driver on either side. The second most important, and really the most important safety aspect is, it removes the motorcycle from the pinch point between two vehicles. Now, I rode down from Portland this morning. It was cold, it was foggy, I'm dressed appropriately, I'm more of a motorcycle dress attire today than an attorney today, but on our way down, sure enough, I was in lane number one, and all the brake lights started going on in front of me, and the car, I mean, we're talking heavy deceleration. Now, fortunately, there was not a vehicle to my right in lane number two. I was able to move over into lane number two. However, if there's a vehicle lane number two, what is my escape point? Where is it? Okay, I'm forced to basically decelerate in the lane or violate the law. And so by decelerating in the lane, assuming motorcyclists are going to comply with the law, they're going to have to decelerate in the lane. And we've all witnessed in commuting traffic what happens when we have stop-and-go traffic situations. You have fender benders, cars impact each other, sometimes injuries result. But when it's a motorcycle, serious, significant, or even fatal injuries can result. So lane filtering, I would call it a more restrictive form of lane splitting, because lane filtering typically, as is practiced globally, involves the filtering of motorcycles to the front of traffic queues, okay, at stoplights or when traffic is slowed. And so it allows them to basically go to the front of the line, because motorcycles can accelerate out faster than cars. It clears them out of the traffic. It clears them out of potential accident situations at stoplights, and allows them to proceed. I should point, 694 does not authorize that here in the state of Oregon, okay, except on highways where the speed limit is posted at 50 miles per hour or greater. But the safety features are still the same. By allowing the motorcycle to get out of the area where rear impacts occur, it takes them out of that danger situation. 40% of all accidents in the United States, according to the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, are rear end accidents. The 2013 Department of Transportation report indicates that 37% of all accidents in the state of Oregon were rear end accidents. Oregon Department of Transportation, in doing their advisory speed study on 217, there are 70% of all accidents on 217 are rear end accidents. There's over 200 accidents a year on 217. So we only need one or two of those to involve motorcycles to have injury consequences. So what 694 does is it essentially allows motorcycles under very limited circumstances to go in between lanes when safe and prudent to do so to avoid potential safety problems. It also allows them during traffic congestion and slowdowns in the case of accidents or tremendous traffic to filter between the lanes, takes them out of the rear-end impact potential, and also incentivizes their use. We have a lot of motorcyclists in the state of Oregon that leave their motorcycle in the garage and drive to work. And they do that because there is no incentive to take their motorcycle. And so every motorcycle on the road is a car that's not on the road. And every car that's not on the road reduces the strain on Oregon's infrastructure. I want to just, and so in looking at 694, how I would characterize it, especially with the Dash 1 amendment, is it's a very limited application, so it's a minimal change to the law. But I think that, if you'll excuse the expression, in terms of bang for the buck, you're getting the maximum safety benefit from the minimal intrusion, because it's going to allow motorcycles to filter between lanes only in those stop-and-go traffic situations where the danger of a rear-end collision is at its highest. I also want to just address the Oregon Department of Transportation's submission, which I saw this morning. The California Highway Patrol did issue guidelines that are consistent with the UC Berkeley study, namely that lane splitting is safest when practiced at speeds under 30 miles per hour in terms of surrounding traffic and when the speed differential is 10 miles per hour or less. Those guidelines were pulled down. The reason why they were pulled down was a petitioner challenged the guidelines under the rulemaking authority of the California Highway Patrol, and apparently there were guidelines in terms of promulgating a rule, they didn't follow the appropriate administrative process. So the guidelines were not pulled down because of any defect in terms of their application, but it was a rulemaking issue. So while the Oregon Department of Transportation cites, and it's true, there have not been, fortunately, rear-end collision fatalities in the state of Oregon in recent years involving motorcycles, the impact is still significant enough for motorcyclists in terms of being in the position to be able to make their own safety decisions. And again, treating motorcycles as cars is an unsafe practice, in my opinion. What we need to do is treat motorcycles as motorcycles. What are their safety advantages? And how can we codify the rules and regulations regarding road use that maximizes their safety benefits while minimizing any disruptive impact on the rest of traffic? And so I hope that you'll look at 694 with the Dash 1 amendment as effectuating that goal, and I urge your passage of 694. Thank you.
Thank you. And so, wrong, JM?
Morning.
Good morning.
I've been riding for 45 years.
I need you to put your name on the record, please.
My name's Jim Broglio.
Jim, okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I've been riding for 45 years. I enjoy it. Ridden all over this country, ridden in Europe. I commute daily on my motorcycle. I've been rear-ended 3 times in traffic, once on the freeway, twice on off-ramps. On the freeway, I was stuck in stop-and-go traffic. An inattentive driver just took me out, pinched me between 2 cars, himself and the car in front of me. It totaled my motorcycle. I received injuries, tore up my gear. And not a fun time. And at the time, it was my only transportation, so made it difficult. Second time, and first time on an off ramp, I was waiting for the signal, and a car anticipated it and neglected to see me, took me out. Again, injuries, totaled motorcycle, and riding gear damaged. Third time, was stuck in traffic on an off ramp, and got hit from behind and stuffed into the car in front of me. So again, I was getting pinched between the cars. I grew up in California, and so I'm familiar with lane sharing, and it has over the years proven out to me it is just that, it's a safety release. It's somewhere to go. And makes it easier when you hear the tires sliding behind you to get between traffic and be out of where you were, mm-hmm. which has been more than once I've looked over and seen the car stop where I was. So I do, by personal experience, see this as a safety thing. It keeps me safe, keeps me out of harm's way. I would encourage you guys to please look at it as a safety feature, and for riders, and again, a bonus with alleviation of traffic. Happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you all. I think your advocacy on this bill has been particularly effective. I've appreciated all of the data that's come with it, and certainly I've heard from people all across the state many times over the last few weeks. So thank you for being very clear and very direct.
All right. Christopher, Senator Thatcher, did you have a question?
Oh, no, not really. I was just thinking about, you're talking about, somebody was talking about Europe and how they have lane sharing there. I think they have lane sharing for cars there, too. I don't think they look at those lines on the road. So, yeah, that was just a thought going through my head.
If that's a question,
really
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Thatcher, I emphasize developed countries, and I've been abroad. Even in Paris around the Arc de Triomphe, where they have a roundabout, there seems to be some sort of musical ballet going on there that I can't appreciate. But and so when we talk about lane filtering and lane sharing, we're not trying to conjure up an image of uncontrolled traffic mayhem that you might see in third world countries. This is the practice that's been safely practiced in Europe for decades, safely practiced in the state of California for decades. And it can be done safely and effectively if it's regulated properly, riders are educated properly, and the public becomes aware. And one of the important safety features, I think, of allowing motorcycles to, currently drivers don't look for motorcycles because they're looking for automobiles. And so, again, looking at the bicycle analogy, now you cannot make a right turn in Portland without checking your right view mirror, okay? 20 years ago, you wouldn't think about that. You would just make the right turn. What do you need to look in your right side mirror for? Well, you have to look for a bicycle. Why are people more aware of bicycles? They're more aware of bicycles because they're being treated differently that we know they're on the roads, we know they have bike lanes, we know about the boxes, we know they have signals, and by incentivizing their use and again, protecting them as much as possible in terms of the safety, and that's part of incentivizing their use, drivers become educated and become more aware of their use. And I can tell you, riding in California, drivers in California are much more comfortable riding around motorcycles. So if lane splitting is such a dangerous and scary thing, why is that? It's because they work together better, and drivers have a better appreciation for motorcycles down there.
All right, I did have one question for you, Christopher. I guess in your descriptions, first of all, I appreciate your current area of practice is dealing with accidents for motorcyclists. So it sounds like you may be losing clientele based on the safety rates of these type of lane splitting and sharing. But I did wonder, in more in the urban areas such as Portland, is there a need to have the bill include bicycles? I'm thinking of where you have multiple lanes and a bike is trying to move over to make a turn, so it leaves that designated lane to do so.
Well, the current 694-1 would prohibit lane filtering or lane splitting, however term you want to use, on urban streets, because the posted speed limits are going to be less than 50 miles per hour. So it's difficult for me to imagine a circumstance that a bicycle under 694-1 would be applicable. But looking forward, I mean, and we know this, it is illegal for bicycles to lane filter also right now. Yet, I can tell you downtown Portland, it happens. So ultimately, as we look forward, as a motorcyclist, as an advocate for motorcycle safety, and I think bicycles have very similar safety issues as motorcycles, I would like to see that. But obviously, that's not what this bill does. And currently, that's also legal in the state of California. And so that's really what filtering, that's what I call filtering, is there's a queue of cars at a red light, and it allows the motorcycles to filter to the front. It allows the bicycles to filter to the front as well, over to the side. Currently, in Portland, we're fortunate to have the bicycle boxes that allow them to filter to the front there. One key difference, I do think, between bicycles and motorcycles, depending upon the bicyclist, of course, is their acceleration from the light when it turns green. Motorcycles tend to clear away from traffic. Bicycles do tend to hold up traffic in terms of accelerating from a green light.
All right, thank you. Any other comments or questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next group,
thank you,
I believe, is Brian Edwards, Sean Severson, and Mike Friend. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Whoever would like to go first, if you'll just put your name on the record.
Okay. Hello, panel, Chairman Senator Przanski, and the rest of the committee. My name is Brian Edwards. I am here as an individual, a lifelong motorcyclist. I am also a instructor for Team Oregon. And just to be clear, I'm not officially representing Team Oregon or speaking on their behalf. It's just everything I say is my personal opinion. I am also a public relations professional, so I might touch briefly on how I think this bill would be perceived by the general public and other parts of the world, country, and so forth. So first thing I want to say is I'm a lifelong motorcyclist. I've been grew up in California, similar to Christopher. I have a lot of experience lane splitting. I used to have a 45-mile commute. I did that for 5 years through really heavy traffic from Riverside, California to Costa Mesa, California. Some of the most congested roadways in the world. I used lane splitting extensively to not only shorten my commute, but also to improve my safety. Throughout that time of multiple years, over 60,000 miles of lane splitting, I encountered no incidents whatsoever, and I found this practice to be very, very safe. So just from my personal experience, I know that lane splitting is a safe way for motorcycles to travel down the highway.
As a Team Oregon instructor, one of the things that's a key principle is we have two key things that I think are applicable here. One is called, as Paula mentioned, something called SIPTE. That stands for Scan, Identify, Predict, Decide, and Execute. So the number one thing, so the four of those pieces are mental. The motorcyclist is constantly scanning the road, making decisions, and identifying threats, making decisions, and then predicting what people are going to be doing. So that dramatically improves safety, is teaching people that process. Along with that is we emphasize the importance of having an escape route. So when you're scanning the roadway, one of the things you're scanning is you're scanning for threats. You're also scanning for escape routes. Where could I go? How can I position myself in a lane? Speed up, slow down, move to the left, move to the right, look at my rearview mirrors, constantly scanning. And then looking for an escape route. Could I go to the left? Could I go to the right? Where is my opening? Unfortunately, you get situations in stop-and-go traffic where there are no escape routes, where you are literally trapped in traffic. You have a car in front of you. You have cars on both sides. You have cars coming up behind you. And unfortunately, in these days, you have drivers who are not attentive. They are on their cell phones. They are playing with their infomercial dashboards that have rear window, you know, cameras all over the place and maps and music, and they're fooling with their temperature controls. They're not paying attention to the road. Those drivers will hit motorcyclists in traffic situations. It's not a big deal to be hit, you know, behind in a stop and go situation if you're in an SUV or a big car. It is a big deal if you're on a motorcycle, as Jim just mentioned. So I would love the opportunity as a Team Oregon instructor to be able to teach my students that there are escape routes between the cars when you're trapped. Go to the left, go to the right, find your way between the traffic. That will dramatically improve your safety. As you're scanning, you see somebody not paying attention, coming up too fast, get out of the way. And I think that is a tremendous safety alternative that I would love to be able to teach to my students. Now I ask, students ask me, well, what can I do if I have somebody tailgating me and they're not paying attention? The answer is you have limited options. So it puts you in a really vulnerable spot with no real recourse. So I feel like that would be, the passage of this bill would make a huge difference in the way we're able to educate new riders coming into motorcycling. The third piece is, I think, the, you know, looking at this bill, a big question is going to be in the general public. So does this mean motorcycles can now legally zip by me? And that's their biggest concern. People in cars do not like a motorcycle going past them at 70 miles an hour when they're basically stopped. And the answer is that's still illegal. If people are doing that, the police need to stop that. They can enforce it. And I think this bill actually gives the police greater ability to enforce it because it puts some constraints, some speed definitions. 10 miles an hour is too much. Cops can sit with radar guns, catch motorcycles ripping between lanes over faster than what the law allows. So I think in some hands that will improve enforcement of that. And I think the fact that we're able to communicate to other drivers, this is safe lane splitting, lane sharing, something that's not currently allowed, but will improve safety for motorcycles on one hand, and additionally, it'll reduce congestion. So I think this bill, if it passes, would receive tremendous media coverage, and I think the word would get out very quickly to the general public that this is safe motorcycling, not unlimited lane splitting, lane sharing. It would also be, I think, send a message to the rest of the country. Oregon is progressive. It's looking out. It's thinking ahead and making a difference in motorcycle safety. And so I think that would send a statement to other states who would, I think, probably very quickly follow suit. Similar bills are moving through legislation in the other parts of the country, and I think the time is absolutely right for this bill just because of distracted driving and the need to improve safety.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Senator Pozanski and members of the committee, my name is Sean Severson, and I'm a resident of Beaverton, Oregon. I've lived in Oregon for the last 10 years and previously resided in the state of California for over 17 years. I'm an avid motorcycle rider and have been riding on and off the road for over 30 years. I've been very involved in the motorcycle community, having participated in racing, volunteering for Oregon Motorcycle Road Racing Association, participated in training and track days at Portland International Speedway, and also entered and raced a number of off-road events in California. While living in California, I experienced a commute of all commutes, traveling 180 miles every day round trip from the San Joaquin Valley into the Bay Area where I worked. Anyone that has traveled or lived in California understands what kind of traffic there can be in metropolitan areas. Friday afternoons are an absolute nightmare. For quite a number of years before I had purchased a street motorcycle of my own, I watched as motorcycles would cruise effortlessly between the miles of stopped traffic. I have to admit, at first it bothered me because these guys, you know, I felt like they were cutting in front of me. But I soon realized that this wasn't the case. If all these motorcycles were in cars, it would take me even longer to get where I'm going. I purchased a new motorcycle and quickly joined the motorcyclists filing through miles of traffic. It was a very relaxing and liberating experience. Stress levels and commute times dropped, and I was getting 45 miles to the gallon. Over the next decade, I saved countless hours and fuel, as well as other drivers' time and fuel, by riding safely between cars and stopped traffic. Over the years and miles that I have practiced this, never did I myself or anybody I was riding with or did I witness ever have an accident caused by lane splitting. It also became more apparent to me that riding between cars and stopped traffic was safer than in the lane in stop-and-go traffic. The first thing a motorcyclist does in a situation where quick braking is required is to look in his rearview mirror, see if the motorist behind him is either stopping or barreling down on him towards impact. If lane splitting, a motorcyclist simply moves between lanes and continues to proceeding forward with no concern for what the vehicle behind them may or may not be doing. This also makes a motorcyclist safer with 100% of their concentration being directed towards what is in front of them. There is generally plenty of room in between lanes of traffic to proceed safely through. However, occasionally some wider vehicles can obstruct the passage of a motorcycle. As a motorcyclist, I was grateful to many of the drivers in California who were aware of my presence and intent to pass and gave me a little extra room. Over the years that this practice has been in effect, drivers have become accustomed to motorcyclists proceeding between lanes and generally are courteous and giving us a little extra space. I usually respond with a wave or thumbs up. I think it is my duty as a motorcyclist to also be courteous when lane filtering. In 2005, my family and I moved back to Oregon to be closer to friends and family and to escape the 180-mile round trip I had been experiencing for so long. I brought with me my love for riding motorcycles and looked forward to a 19-mile commute instead of a 180-mile commute. It seemed like it'd be a piece of cake. I soon learned of the wrath of Portland traffic coming from Beaverton to Milwaukee. Most of that time spent on Highway 26 through the tunnel in and out of Portland. I also very quickly learned that riding my motorcycle wasn't quite as fun and appealing as it had been in the past. No longer able to easily pass through stopped traffic, I found myself sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic, pumping my clutch and getting nowhere any quicker than if I was in my car or truck. I also had to concern myself again with the dangers of being rear-ended in this traffic. It didn't take long for the benefits of riding my motorcycle to be outweighed by the dangers of sitting in traffic and the lack of time savings. Weather is obviously a factor more in Oregon, but I found myself preferring to just sit in a climate-controlled 17-mile-per-gallon vehicle than sit exposed in traffic, even if my motorcycle gets nearly three times the gas mileage. In the 10 years since moving to Oregon, I have only put about 5,000 miles on my motorcycle, which is like trips to, you know, St. Helens or on weekends. Where previous years in California, I averaged almost double that per year. The use of my motorcycle had been greatly reduced by the lack of time savings and the dangers of riding in a lane of slow traffic. In 2012, my fears were realized when on Highway 26 in bumper-to-bumper traffic, I was rear-ended by a woman traveling approximately 50 miles per hour. The accident destroyed her car, and insurance called my truck a total loss. Had I been traveling my motorcycle, I would have been stopped in the lane and been rear-ended. This type of impact could have proved fatal. This is why we need lane filtering. Most importantly, it moves motorcycles out of the most prevalent and dangerous crash zone. In addition, it encourages the use of fuel and space-saving vehicles. Most motorcycles get 2 to 3 times the fuel mileage of vehicles, and scooters even twice that. For the safety and promotion of motorcycling, I strongly urge the committee to recommend the passage as SB 694. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yes.
Hello, good morning. Dear Chair Brzezanski and members of the committee, my name is Mike Friend and I live in Southeast Portland. Thank you for allowing me to speak today regarding Senate Bill 694, which will allow motorcyclists to filter through highway or freeway traffic when it is stopped or very slow. I've been riding for over 40 years, and my motorcycles are my main source of transportation, and I believe this bill will increase motorcycle safety in our public highways and interstates. For motorcyclists to be able to filter through our highways and interstate traffic when traffic is stopped or going less than 10 miles an hour will be a huge benefit for riders. Please also keep in mind that this bill allows riders to travel no faster than 20 miles an hour, which is the same rate as vehicles are to travel in school zones. So therefore, you know, at these very low speeds, nobody's really going to get seriously hurt while filtering. A concern for riders in our streets and highways is rear-end collisions, which make up 40% of all crashes in the United States. And as you can imagine, a rear-end collision with a car hitting another car is survivable, as Sean just mentioned. But a car or a heavy vehicle rear-ending a motorcycle will likely be very serious, if not fatal, for the rider and the passenger. So even a low-speed rear-end collision can be disastrous. The California Highway Office of Traffic Safety recently did a study and found that motorcyclists who took advantage of lane filtering were less likely to be involved in rear-end collisions. They found that 97% of the riders were not involved in any type of accident, and for those that were in an accident, 6% of them indicated only incurred minor injuries. They also found that the majority of riders who filtered their way through traffic did so lawfully and at prudent speeds. In a recent California Highway Patrol study, there were 55% fewer fatalities in lane filtering accidents versus non-lane filtering accidents. The limited number of accidents can be attributed to lower speeds and to motorcycles being removed from the driver's blind spot when they ride between lanes. Motorcycles are out of the driver's blind spot and then they're placed right in the lane between the cars in direct view of the driver's or truck's side mirrors, so we're very easy to see. There are other advantages to lane filtering as well. Traffic flows better because there is one less vehicle in the lane, and therefore drivers can move ahead, allowing them to get to their destination sooner. The motorcycle is gone and ahead of the driver, so there's no more worry for the driver about the motorcyclist. We're gone. And by removing hundreds of vehicle spaces from a crowded highway is going to help traffic congestion at the same time, providing a measure of safety for the rider. But anyway, I hope you find this information useful, and again, I ask your support for Senate Bill 694. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And let's see. Questions?
Just a brief one.
Go right ahead.
And I wish I had glanced at this report that, or legislation, excuse me, testimony that ODOT gave to all of us up here. And they were mentioning some reports. And I don't know if you are talking about the same reports, but here's what they said. It said lane sharing is practiced in California, but it's neither expressly allowed nor prohibited in statute. And the University of California at Berkeley has been conducting a study of motorcycle crashes and lane splitting. However, after briefly releasing the report, they withdrew it. Are you talking about that report, or are you talking about a different study?
It's a different study.
That was actually released with results
released,
and all that. Okay.
And from what I could see, it was it's a study that's done every year that they release, and so we've had some very good results from that.
And then a follow-up, because they said also that similarly the California State Patrol issued guidelines on lane splitting and then withdrew them.
That's the one that Christopher mentioned earlier.
Okay.
It's the same report, and it was just withdrawn because of a administrative detail, not because there were any real issues with the port or the CHP didn't recommend it or support it. So.
Okay. And then a follow-up. Thank you. And then they also talk about in this report that there were, over the past 8 years, the crash data for motorcyclists stopped on main highways, not talking about ramps or connections, is my understanding, that there were 14 crashes on the main highways, no fatalities, thank goodness, 21 injuries. and they're saying that the data suggests that the benefit of what would be contained in this bill would be minuscule. What would you say to that?
Two things. One may be that some motorcyclists are practicing lane splitting illegally. So they're anticipating, they're scanning and looking behind them and seeing drivers coming up and they lane split anyway, illegally. So it'd be good, you know, this bill would allow them to do that and make it allow us to educate newer riders that they can do that. I'm also confused by some of those numbers in that 40% of accidents nationally, according to the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, occur, you know, they are rear-end accidents in cars and vehicles. So 40% of accidents. So I think there is more risk than what is represented by that data. And I particularly think that in the last few years, the electronics that we have in our car and our phones has massively increased. And so people are more distracted than they have ever been before. I mean, that's a huge trend, and it's not getting any better. If you look at what's in the new cars today, the electronics that are packed into the dashboard, unbelievable. People are on their Bluetooth, they're on their phones. They are simply not paying attention to vehicles in front of them, and they don't appreciate the risk that their inattention presents to people on motorcycles. And so, like Mike was saying, if we can just get through the traffic and get out of the way, we're removed from that risk.
Another thing is motorcyclists, we're very good at seeing what's going on around us at all times. So I can envision lane filtering, and you know, we can see the drivers in their cars and what they're doing and what's happening. And you can very easily spot, like if a car is going to try to move over into your lane, you just notice the change in distance from the white line to the tire. You can see how that will narrow, you know, whether they're going to make a lane change even without turning on a signal. You know, you kind of get all these indicators, and we just have these finely tuned senses for these things. So I would anticipate, and at 20 miles an hour, again, everything's much slower. You've got more time to take care of any situation that comes up that I think that we will find it'll be a very safe practice. Anyway, thank you for listening.
One comment. I think it's
we have another panel, and we have some other stuff, so if you can make it short, that'd be
great. Yeah, real quick. Sorry, Senator Przanski, members of the committee. I think it's just like being a pedestrian on a street where they teach you to walk, you know, facing traffic. I mean, you do that because you can see cars coming towards you. And I think on a motorcycle, it's the same thing. If you're stuck in traffic, you've got traffic whizzing up from behind you, you can't see the dangers coming. If you're a motorcyclist and you're proceeding, you know, through traffic and everything is coming towards you from ahead of you, then you can see what's coming towards you and react. So I think that's a similar situation as being a pedestrian and being encouraged to walk towards traffic.
Okay. All right. Thank you all very much. Our next panel includes Robert Reichenberg, Courtney Olive, and Patrick Leshock. Shackley, I guess. I can't tell.
Leshock?
We'll learn soon enough. Okay, who's going first?
Chair Przanski and committee, my name is Robert Reichenberg. I am chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. I'm here to express the committee's support for this bill. I should say, in clarification, the committee voted 4-3 in favor of this bill, so even motorcyclists are split on the issue. As a former lane splitter myself, I can say that lane splitting requires a lot of alertness, skill, and knowledge. And California has a very different freeway culture in the sense that motorcycles have been a presence between lanes for as long as anyone can remember. We certainly would recommend that if this bill moves forward, that it be linked with an awareness and education campaign, and that legislation should address speed and enforcement issues, because they will be an issue with this bill. I thank you. Prepared to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. And who'd like to go next?
I will. Good morning, Chairman Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is Courtney Olive. I'm a resident of Portland in Senate District 22, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 694.
Courtney, if I can get you to just take one of the mics, I think you're speaking loud enough, but just make sure it gets recorded. Thank you.
Sure, gladly. Along with Mr. Reichenberg, I have served on the Governor's Advisory Committee for Motorcycle Safety. I served on that committee from 2008 until 2013. I was appointed by Governor Kulongowski initially and also served under Governor Kitzhaber. I've been riding for 14 years. I'm also a part-time motorcycle journalist, so I've written in a number of national and international publications. I am a member of the Sang Foy Riding Club, SFRC. We're an Oregon nonprofit corporation, and we're a riding group in Portland. And I'm a practicing attorney. I work for the Bonneville Power Administration. Of course, my comments here in no way represent Bonneville's views. I don't really care about this sort of thing. What I want to do today, I submitted written comments on this yesterday, and I think you'll find my comments to be quite thorough on this issue. I've spent many years looking at lane sharing since about 2007, and what I attempted to do in my written comments was put into one place for you all of the studies that have been done on lane sharing, all of the experts that have looked at this, all of the industry editors of motorcycle publications and so forth, so that you can have one sort of clearinghouse of resources to go investigate the practice of lane sharing on your own. So I won't belabor all the points in my comments, but I do want to hit three key areas. Number one, this is good public policy. It relieves congestion, and by doing so, it also is an easy way to lower CO2 emissions and other noxious gases from motor vehicles. The second thing I want to talk about is misperceptions with regard to lane sharing, and I'll get into that. And the third thing, and what I really want to focus on, is the data and this California study. Senator Thatcher, you just mentioned it. It was referred to in the letter that you received from ODOT.
Courtney, I'm going to ask you, we have had a lot of testimony on those different points. If you can summarize instead of going in greater detail, I think we've got that stuff, and we prefer having your written testimony for you to summarize what you want to bring up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't plan to belabor any of these points. The first, that it's good public policy and it relieves congestion. As you've heard already this morning, moving a vehicle out of the ordinary line of traffic gets everybody where they're going much faster. This isn't only common sense. It's been proven. You'll find on my comments there is a study from Belgium that was done on this topic. Again, in Europe, this practice is legal and commonly done, so I point you to my comments and the study from Belgium that shows that if 10% of drivers were to switch to motorcycles and filter, driving times could be reduced by as much as 8 minutes per destination. So that's been documented, and I think it's really just kind of common sense. One thing that hasn't been talked about a lot today is the decrease in emissions and the CO2 reduction benefits. If you have vehicles idling for less time, both motorcycles and cars, you're going to get a massive reduction in CO2 emissions. We know that vehicle idle time is when emissions are at their highest. This will help lower that. I'll just mention briefly my second point about misperceptions about this. The nice thing about Bill 694 is that it's narrowly tailored. As has been discussed today, it only applies to major highways that have posted speed limits of 50 miles an hour or greater, and it only applies in traffic jam situations. So we're talking about a very limited purpose that really takes great steps to ensure that there is quite a bit of safety involved. One other quick study I want to point to is a 2009 study that was conducted in the European Union. This was called the Motorcycle Accident In-Depth Study, or MAIDS study. I've cited to that in my testimony as well. And in that study, this was a very exhaustive study in all the countries in the European Union, and it found that lane sharing or lane filtering, whatever you want to call the practice, was only a factor in 0.5% of motorcycle crashes. So 0.5% of crashes were affected by lane sharing. Lastly, what I want to talk about is hard data from the California study. And particularly, Senator Thatcher, you asked about the ODOT reference to the University of California, Berkeley study. With due respect to the ODOT, I think that's incorrect. The study is still available on the California Office of Traffic Highway Safety's website. To my knowledge, it has never been withdrawn. The study was released just in August of 2014, so it's still there. It's very thorough. The study was, as I said, conducted by the California Office of Traffic Safety. They hired the University of California at Berkeley to perform the study, and the California Highway Patrol was the predominant agency that collected the data on it. And it's not a small study either. They collected 8,000, almost 8,000 crashes worth of data. So that study is very important, and it's still on the books, to my knowledge. The question about what has been withdrawn, that's the California Highway Patrol's lane splitting guidelines. Again, those were only withdrawn because of they weren't properly promulgated under administrative law, not because of any substantive reason for those. Last point I want to note about data and safety organizations is that even the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has recognized, and I quote, "There is evidence that traveling between lanes of stopped or slow-moving cars, i.e. lane splitting, on multiple lane roads, such as interstate highways," this is exactly where 694 would apply, "slightly reduces crash frequency compared with staying within the lane and moving with other traffic." So that's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. That was from 2009. That was before we even had the good data from California from last August. This is widely supported by motorcycle consumer groups. The American Motorcycle Association supports it, and the editors of motorcycle magazines such as Motorcycle Consumer News, which is sort of the consumer reports of motorcycling, thoroughly support it. Thank you for your indulgence and your time and your thorough consideration of this.
Thank you, Courtney.
My name is Patrick Layshock. I'm from Oregon Senate District Number 22. I'm a board member of the Sangfoa Riding Club, and I'm a former member and vice chair of Oregon's Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. I support Senate Bill 694-1, and I thank you for your time today. There are two things I want to address today. First of all, that lane filtering, lane sharing has been and is strongly supported by the riding community in Oregon. The second is that there is enough data, there is enough information to bring this bill to a vote of the people. I don't want to do this by discussing reports. What I want to do is put this bill in a little bit of historical context. I began attending governor's advisory committees as a citizen in 2005. I became a member shortly thereafter. Lane splitting, lane filtering was actively discussed at the time. And once I became a member of the committee, the single biggest thing I got asked about, I got questioned about by riders, was when are you going to bring lane splitting to Oregon? Bar none. This was discussed in committee. However, the opinion reached by most of us, myself not included, was that there was not enough information. There wasn't enough data to move forward on a bill. 2007-2008, I helped co-found the Portland City Motorcycle and Scooter Advisory Committee. One of the main topics of that committee, lane splitting. When are we going to get lane splitting? If we can't do it as an Oregon state bill, can we make it legal in Portland? Even riders who wouldn't lane split themselves supported lane splitting. 2010, Oregon's Governor's Advisory Committee formed a town hall meeting in Portland, Oregon. Over 100 riders showed up, and almost without exception, riders testified in support either of lane splitting itself or of the committee doing further investigation on lane splitting. Unfortunately, the committee that night voted against doing further research against lane splitting. It's 2015. It's been over 9 years since I've first become engaged with motorcycle-related legislation in this state. Public opinion of riders in favor of lane splitting is stronger than ever. The Governor's Advisory Committee, which in prior years has voted against either lane splitting or researching lane splitting, has now voted in support of this bill. These are the experts that the state relies on to make decisions and judgments about motorcycle-related legislation. I think we should listen to them. Again, my point is that, or two, first is that Oregon motorcyclists support this bill and have consistently supported lane splitting for at least 9 years. And I think the facts I mentioned show that. My second point is that the objection that there is not enough data to allow us to come to a vote of the people is no longer compelling. This is especially true in light of the Berkeley study that was released in August last year. We're never going to have perfect information on which to make a decision. However, there is enough information to make a decision today. Oregon has a tremendous opportunity to lead in motorcycle safety, and I ask that you please support Senate Bill 694. Thank you for your time. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Amy Joyce.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, today representing our Transportation Safety Division. I have submitted some written testimony, and I'll go over a few points, but there were a number of points raised that I want to address. First, as to the study that has been discussed, there are two different items. There's an observational study, which is roughly experts stand at the side of the road and observe what people do. We do that here in Oregon in terms of seatbelt use, helmet use, that kind of thing. There is a study out there on that. The Berkeley study regarding the safety of lane splitting has been withdrawn. There is a summary that's still online. I will be happy to get you written information to confirm the status of those reports. But beyond that, you know, in my written testimony, we summarized the safety aspects here. And the data, we pulled 8 years' worth of data that would be covered under the Dash 1 amendments that I think is really the version of the bill that's being discussed. So that 50 miles per hour or greater where this would be allowed. We pulled the data for 8 years and the number of motorcyclists involved in rear end being rear-ended is a tiny, tiny amount. Much greater is the number of motorcyclists killed in traffic, 75% to 80% of which are caused by the motorcyclists themselves. So, you know, what I think we need to be focusing on is how do we not put motorcyclists in more risky situations? And that's what you have with lane splitting. They're in very close quarters. You have folks who aren't expecting them in passenger vehicles, light trucks, heavy trucks, and in stopped situations, maybe opening a door, maybe beginning to move into to the adjacent lane to start a lane change in slow and stop traffic without looking. So we want to be putting motorcyclists in less risky situations, not more risky situations. And, you know, just to go over some of the points that were raised, you know, a number of folks raised the issue of being stopped behind others and vehicles coming up suddenly behind them. And I think, you know, one of the items was there's no escape route. Or what are they supposed to do? It's a well-established part of the law that in an emergency kind of a situation, sort of a choice of evils situation, you're going to be able to move and do something that normally you wouldn't be allowed to do to avoid being crushed from behind. So, you know, I think there are real significant safety concerns with the idea of lane splitting. And I will be following up with additional information about the report so that you have before you the actual information and can resolve that kind of disagreement about where those studies are.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 694. Now, we have a number of bills that are set for work session. One of them is 941. I'm going to make an announcement here regarding 941. Senator Thatcher has a new amendment, has just been posted about 45, 50 minutes ago. Out of courtesy for Senator Thatcher, I am not going to move the bill today or have a work session on the bill, because we would not be able to have the discussion until 9:57 without a rule suspension. Also knowing that Senator Cruz has a leadership meeting that he needs to go to at 9:45, I think in the good interest that we will just carry over Senate Bill 941 to Monday, out of courtesy for my two colleagues. So those who are here for Senate Bill 941, work session will be carried over to this coming Monday. I apologize for the wait, but we were waiting for other stuff to happen. And out of this point, out of deference to Senator Thatcher, I am going to go ahead and not try to have the work session today because of that. So with that said, we're going to go ahead and go into, I don't know, is Gail Meyer still in the room?
She has somebody else for her.
Okay. Yeah. So let me just make sure to see we've closed the public hearing on the last bill, which is 694. Eric, what else do you have? Because I know Jeff's also here.
I have most of everything else. I have 908, 919, 199, 377, and 384.
All right. So, Jeff, let me ask you what you have on yours that besides the 941.
Senate Bill 391.
391? And is it ready? Let's see.
It is, with the dash one amendments.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 391. Jeff?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 391 prohibits the seizure of a deposit for security release in a criminal case without obtaining a search warrant or court order. The bill requires a court order for a transfer or distribution of property after seizure. We have proposed dash ones before us that state that the person designated by the magistrate to accept security in a criminal case acts as the agent of the court for that purpose. It requires the court clerk to accept security during normal business hours. The dash one amendments specify that security may be posted in the form of cash, cashier's check, credit card, or money order. We're ready to move with the dash one amendments this morning.
That one too, which is the rewrite for Betsy Johnson's for the... All right, so we're ready for the dash ones.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment, Senate Bill 391.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 391. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 391 as amended by the dash one amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 391 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended by the dash ones, I should say, with the due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see, carrier on that will be, I'll sign the carrier afterwards. Okay, and let's see, we closed the work session on 391, and I misplaced my sheet, so what else we got?
We do the 908, that's the one we have the witness for, or just do the
witness? Okay, we have 908, we have that, and then 919, I think that's one I just want to open up right now, Senate Bill 919. Colleagues, if you remember, we had testimony on trying to change the disorderly conduct from a second-degree offense to a first-degree offense. We didn't have a relating clause, if I remember correctly, that was broad enough to do that. This was a bill that Senator Johnson had brought forward regarding, I forget which county. Eric, why don't you give us a little bit more on that?
Sure. The original, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, the original bill was Senate Bill 334. It came out of Columbia County with a bomb threat at the courthouse. And the bill we heard testimony about on February 5th elevated disorderly conduct from a B misdemeanor to an A misdemeanor for the first offense and a C felony for the second offense. But there was the relating to clause issue. We wanted, we talked about having the bill encompass both public buildings and courthouses. Senate Bill 919 does that, and it is ready to move. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, and the one that we're going to reference was 334 or 339?
334.
All right, so Chair is asking to incorporate the testimony we did, in fact, here on Senate Bill 334 into the record for Senate Bill 919. And with that, unless there's someone else who'd like to give testimony, we have no one listed for Senate Bill 919. Not seeing anyone wanting to come forward, we'll close that public hearing, opening a work session on Senate Bill 919.
Chair, move Senate Bill 919 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 919 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Johnson will be our carrier on that bill. We'll close that work session, and then I think it brings us up to that one's ready too. Senate Bill 199. So we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 199.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 199 came to this committee from the Office of the Governor. We heard this bill on February 26. The bill addresses a rarely used statute whereby the parole board can discharge a prisoner earlier if continued detention is cruel and inhumane. It is used most frequently, if at all, at end-of-life cases with severe medical issues. The bill requires victim notification of these release decisions, set timelines for notification, and affords other rights. The Dash 1 amendment modifies the bill to simply require victim notification in these situations, but eliminates the time period and other provisions. There is a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and it's ready to move.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 199.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendment for Senate Bill 199. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 199 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 199 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry Senate Bill 199. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 199. And go to Senate Bill, open up a work session on Senate Bill 377.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 377 came from the Interim Judiciary Committee. We heard testimony on this bill on March 10th. There was a situation where there was concern about whether Oregon's theft statutes covered stealing intimate images from computer devices or other phones. This bill, with the Dash 2 amendment, modifies Oregon's computer crime statute and makes it a Class C felony to steal intimate images from another person's computer or phone. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, and the bill is ready to move with the Dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 377.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendment into Senate Bill 377. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 377 as amended by the Dash 2 amendment to the Senate floor to due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 moves Senate Bill 377 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And let's see. Would Senator Hass want to carry this? Well, I mean, we'll carry it. I tell you what, we'll sign a carrier later. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 377, and then that opens up our public hearing, I believe, on Senate Bill 908. And Eric, why don't you do that? Senator Cruz, I know you probably need to take off.
Yeah, are you moving that or just hearing it?
We'll just hear it today.
Okay.
We'll
okay.
just do that.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 908 is a committee bill. It modifies Oregon's expungement statute. Motor vehicle violations currently do not start the retolling of the expungement timeline. Senate Bill 908 adds two other violations, minor in possession of alcohol and possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, to the list of violations that do not continue to toll the expungement timeline. There is no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. And let's see, who do we have? Come on up. I know Gail was scheduled. I know that. And that's quite all right.
Good morning. My name is Kimberly Davis, here on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we definitely appreciate the concept of this bill. We believe that even 10 years violation would disqualify a whole lot of people that maybe it's not necessary. Our caution, however, is that we are currently in negotiations with the district attorney's office in redrafting the entire expungement statutes. And on the table currently is the number of violations and which type of violations would be counted. So we hesitate to take a position at this time, as we're still in good faith negotiations. And Chair Przanski, Gail, today is meeting at 10:30 with Jeff Howes on this very issue.
All right. Well, thank you. We're just putting this more on the record. I know Senator Gelser has some comments as well, but let me see if there's any questions for Kimberly. All right. Thank you for putting that on the record. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I brought this to our committee at the request of a constituent who did a lot of work with students at Oregon State University. And the issue is that frequently these people will be young folks that get a minor in possession or less than an ounce of marijuana. They don't find an attorney. They plead to it, and then later maybe they had a shoplifting charge, and for 10 years they can't get the record expunged because of that minor in possession, and they're unemployable. So that's the intent.
Okay. Well, we'll take up more on this. I just want to get that all on the record. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Let me ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 908. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 908. And I believe that takes care of everything, except I know I need to carry over.
There's 384. I forgot about that.
384. Oh, sorry. Open up. Boy, thank you for saving me. All right. We'll open the work session on 394. I can see the eyes already. Whoa.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 384. We heard testimony on this. This requires shorthand court reporters in aggravated murder cases. We do have a -1 amendment that pretty much came from the OJD, clarifying the language of court reporters to make it consistent with other parts of ORS. There is a fiscal, and so with the -1 amendments, it would need to go to Ways and Means. It is ready to be moved.
Yeah, you know, I'm unfortunately in an awkward situation. I'm going to get death by stairs no matter what. Senator Cruz had to go to a leadership meeting. He asked if I was going to be moving any other bills today. I told him no. I'd forgot that this was on the schedule. So I, out of courtesy and out of what I've told him, even though he probably would not have a problem, I'm not comfortable moving it today. So I apologize to the interested parties who have sat through here most of the day, who will be back on Monday, and I will try to make certain that's up first. So I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on the Senate Bill 384, and I apologize to those who have been here for this long, but out of my word to my colleague, I'm not going to do that at this time. And so I think that at this point, I still need to carry over the one which we had this morning, which is Senate Bill 839. So we're going to be carrying Senate Bill 839 over until Monday, and I believe all we need to do on that one is the work session.
That's correct.
And so we'll be carrying over the work session on Senate Bill 389 to Monday of this next week. And speaking of Monday, I have the agendas that are going to be given to council and staff for this next week. I will want to just let you know we are going to modify our agenda for Monday. Instead of being here at 8 a.m., Senator Burdick, we will not need to be here until 8:30. Out of courtesy for my other colleagues on the dais today. So with that, is there anything else that I need to do to tie the knots for the rest of the day?
Oh.
You did carry over 941.
The submission of testimony. Jeff wanted to know if you wanted to carry
that. Let's go ahead and do that right now. We're going to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 941. The purpose of this, colleagues, after the 5 p.m. deadline that we had for testimony to come in, there are a number of individuals who have sent testimony in through the internet. The chair is going to go ahead and have this entered into the testimony instead of not allowing it to be in. So we will take the testimony that was received after 5 p.m. Up until this morning, I believe, it has been posted. Or tell me the deadline.
Well, the question is whether we want to allow continued submission until the work session on Monday. We're still getting submissions as we speak.
Sure. We'll do that. All right. So what we'll do is we'll modify. I guess I'm wondering, do we need to actually do a vote, or is this a call of the chair? All right, the chair is going to go ahead and allow for testimony to continue to come in until Monday morning, until we have our work session. Just do it that way. That way we'll have a break time based on when we complete. So any other housekeeping that we need to do? All right, so colleagues, we'll see you on Monday. Since we are not meeting tomorrow for floor session, there'll be no committee meeting, and we'll be back this coming Monday at 8:30. And we'll be back in our regular room, 343, I believe. And as I said, the two bills that are being carried over for work sessions, 839 and 941 for this coming Monday.
And 384.
And 384, yes, those three. Boy, that would be another death with stairs. With that, we're adjourned.
Sorry, I didn't catch that earlier.
Adjourned.
Sorry, I didn't catch that earlier.
With that, we're